So today we're going to touch on something near and dear to my heart, counterpoint, an amazing skill for all composers, something that was a highlight of my learnings in college and something that I've been playing with a lot lately. So wanted to share that with you and help you make use of another tool in the Tune Shed. So everybody, welcome to the Tune Shed, the workshop for everything music from history, theory, creative process, production, you name it. We're here to become better music listeners, better creators, and better music lovers. I'm your host, Mike Blurry, and I am not here with Marty today. He is out working. He's been on the grind lately. So it's always sad to do a session without him, but we got to keep this thing cruising. It is a hobby for us, not a job. But of course, if you want to support the podcast, we have a link in the description, and we'd very much appreciate that. We invested all back into the podcast to grow this thing and make it a better experience. But yeah, so Marty's out working. So we've been working on this instrument that's really awesome. I'm super stoked on it. But we're going to have to release that when he gets back. So we're going to have to pause on that. Thank you for your patience. But I've been cooking up a little something to talk about and go over, and something that's just kind of fun to go over anyways, which is counterpoint. And essentially, counterpoint is the study of how to make voices sound good together, how to make melodies sound good together. So we'll get into it in some detail, but I guess we should start at the beginning. Of course, it's a very good place to start with scales. So when you play music on the piano or on the guitar or whatever instrument, or singing, you usually play in a scale. And a lot of you know what scales are. You might have heard Sound of Music, do, a deer, a female deer. So do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do is a way to express a scale. And oftentimes, music is in a key, and with a key and a scale are sort of the same thing. But you don't always stay in the same key, in the same scale. Sometimes you move around. Like everything in music, it's sort of a rule that's made to be broken. So I was thinking about that. You know, it's good to have a constraint, a scale. It helps you do something, express something. It sort of gives you a playground to play on. And it's good to break that rule too, if it's not serving you. So a classic example, you know, everybody, you know, might know what a blues scale sounds like. You might be able to recognize it. That's a great tool for writing blues music. You might want to do that a little bit in a song and then move on to something else to sort of express some bluesiness, but not make it all blues. Something you want to add something else in. So scales are just tools to help you do something. And so I guess within that, the next concept to get into is voices or melodies. And so melodies are, there's no real strong definition. It's just sort of a collection of notes that becomes memorable. And for me, it usually becomes memorable because of something like repetition. It's repeated a few times and all of a sudden it starts to sort of set in. Sometimes it's just so catchy. A lot of pop songs are just so catchy. Shawty's like a melody in my head. Like that, oh, instantly hits and is stuck in your head. And those are just notes and scales that are repeated or transposed and, you know, referenced. But what people back in the day, and by back in the day, I mean Bach and before Bach even, were really interested in having multiple melodies that played nice together at the same time. So kind of a weird concept. So instead of saying, okay, I'm going to strum my guitar and sing a note, I have my harmony on the guitar. I have the note that is what I'm singing. That's my melody. They wanted two melodies going at the same time. And actually, it's happening all over modern music today. There's lots of things. Logan, who came on the podcast, shout out to Logan, the Vibe Machine, calls it an underlick sometimes, where there's kind of two things happening together at once. And it can be challenging to write these. Counterpoint is like a 400 level class in music schools to study it in depth. But there's some really simple ways to do it without overthinking the concept. So we'll get into some of those today. So when would we want to use this? I think a great example, let's say you're writing for a barbershop quartet. You're writing for four people singing. And you wouldn't want to do it like a singer-songwriter with a guitar and voice, right? You wouldn't want to say, okay, singer number one, you're going to sing the melody. And then singer number two, three, and four, you're just going to sing block chords together and hold them, or a rhythmic chord structure. Maybe you'd want to do that for a little bit, but if you did that the whole time, it would be a little bit less interesting than if everybody had these moving lines up and down. And what's cool is when all those different lines move, you make them into nice chords. So you have chord progressions that are happening, but they're essentially voiced different. It's not like a block of notes down here and then a melody up there. It's sort of like an even mix of notes. You can think about a piano sort of evenly mixed across the whole piano. Rather than, a block of chords in your left hand and one note in your right hand. And that actually sounds really good when you do it like that. So that could be a reason to sort of want to do counterpoint. Another reason is, okay, you have your song, you have your melody, and you want to add some more interest to it. You want to have a part that's really alive, it's its own thing, but you also want to have the melody, and you don't want those things to compete. And you want them to sit nicely together. Sometimes you might have two things that are already there and they're just conflicting a little bit. And you're saying, why does this sound weird? I know there's something wrong here. I don't know enough about music theory. This is really annoying. So a little bit of counterpoint can help you with that too, to just go in and say, okay, the problem area is here. What should I switch? What should I tweak? So it's a really good tool. And then the last thing I think is awesome about counterpoint is it's a great compositional device. So you've written part of a song, you need to write the next part, you're totally stuck. This happens to me all the time. Or, oh, I need a bridge, or, oh, I need this or that. It's a great way to say, hey, I've already written a lot of great musical content here. I have a melody, or I have a theme, and I'm going to take that theme and use it as a starting place. Maybe I will slow it down, I'll double the time, and I'll put it in the bass. Okay, now I have a bass line. And that bass line will tie really nice with the theme from the earlier sections because it's the same thing, but just sort of manipulated. Or maybe I'll move that same theme into another key, another scale, and I'll use that. So then there's a tie between that first section and the second section. And then you compose off of that. It's something to sort of like a sounding board to start your idea. So that's helped me a lot, those little compositional techniques. Maybe you do the theme backwards. There's lots of cool, kind of fun things you can do that are out there. And I challenge you all to go listen to your favorite songs and look for these types of things. Look for when there's two lines interacting in a really cool way. I always think about the bass line and the melody. Oftentimes, you could argue that that's counterpoint. One thing that's specific about counterpoint, though, is that it's supposed to have both melodies be independent and sort of singable and good as standalone melodies. So with the bass line example, if you have a really cool bass line that you love, I love that bass line from Tame Impala, The Less I Know the Better. Boom, ba-dum, boom, 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 boom. And then he starts singing over that. But that's a melody, right? It's kind of singable. And forgive my singing, I'm not a singer, but I kind of like that bass line on its own. And then he sings on top of it, and I like how he sings on its own. And they fit together nicely. Okay, so how do we do it? Let's get into some details, some examples of this to think about. Oh, one other great example, an amazing example, really seems like a fundamentally basic thing, but row, row, row your belt is a round. And I don't know if people have heard about rounds before, but essentially the way it's supposed to be sung, most people just sing it, just sing row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. But when you sing it with multiple people is where it gets fun. So let's say singer one goes, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. And right when they hit stream, singer two can start, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. And when singer two hits that, singer three can start. And rounds are this, they're songs that are designed so they're offset, right? Each melody is offset from the next melody. Each singer is offset from the next person. But if you paused at any point in time and looked vertically across the singers, okay, what note are you singing? What note are you singing? What note are you singing? Or on the sheet music vertically, what notes are there? You would see they sit together nicely. They're not dissonant, they're not harsh, they're not musically confusing. So how would you write a song like that? How do you do that? How do you pull it off and make sure that you're writing a melody that sort of at any point in the melody, you can line it up with a different point of the melody and it sounds good. So that's the study of counterpoint. That's what it does. I actually have a great book. If you have video, Counterpoint, fourth edition. Canon. It's a nice satisfying little book, and it kind of goes through some of these things. And there's a deep history to counterpoint. A lot of composers back in the day were using it. I mentioned Bach earlier. And I'll play some Bach inventions later just to take a look at it because they're really cool. And I'll play a part of a piece that I did too to sort of use some compositional techniques. Actually, it just helped me finish the piece. I didn't know what to do. I was stuck. But let's talk a little bit about the history before we get into some Bach. So I guess actually maybe we just start with Bach inventions, a great thing. If you haven't heard of inventions, they're sort of just like a song format back in the day. So today you might have a song, you might have a four chord song. Many people have heard of that. Axis of Awesome did this thing where they showed that all these different pop songs have the same four chords in them. And it's kind of hilarious when you hear all these different songs and you realize, wow, they're exactly the same chords. What is happening here? So an invention is sort of like that, but from back in the day. Inventions usually have three parts. There's sort of this beginning part, they called it the exposition, where a short motif or melody or theme was introduced in one voice. And by one voice, it just means you could think of it as a singer. You could think of it as just, one hand playing it on a keyboard. And usually they did that in the home key. And so they introduced this theme, and then that theme is repeated, but in the second voice. And the first voice goes on to do something else. And now that first voice is playing the counter theme or the counter subject, sometimes they call it. And the relationship between the first theme and the second theme and the first voice and the second voice is counterpoint. And so that's the first section. And that's pretty much the section we'll focus on. It's the simplest part of these themes. And once you know that theme, you sort of hear it throughout the piece. We go on to the development in an invention. It's the bulk of the piece. There's a bunch of sort of variations of the themes. Like I was saying earlier, maybe they slow it down, maybe they speed it up, maybe they reverse it, maybe they do it in a different key. If you're in a minor key, maybe you do it in the relative major key. Maybe you go through a whole bunch of keys really fast and you keep playing with the theme in those different keys. So there's lots of different options there. You can kind of go into some crazy music theory. We won't focus on that as much, but what's cool about these invention pieces is you hear that theme right in the beginning and it's by itself. And then if you just listen for that throughout the piece, you'll hear it again. You'll hear it in different keys. You'll hear it in lower tones, higher tones. And it's kind of fun to sort of just listen for that as you go through. And then usually an invention ends with some sort of recapitulation, they call it. It tends to be short and it's just sort of you repeat the theme in some upper voice to say, hey, we're back home again, and then the song ends. And so inventions, they're sort of a musical nerdy thing. A lot of Bach was writing these for students to sort of understand how they can play around compositionally. Also really expressing the idea that you kind of don't need to write that much original stuff to make a song. A really classic theme. Dun, 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 dun. Da, 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 right? That's all over that piece. It decides a lot of the piece for itself, right? You don't really need to like rewrite this new catchy thing. You're actually just repeating that in different fun ways. So that's why it's a great compositional technique. It makes it so when you get stuck, look back on what you have already and work with it. It's a great way to keep going. And actually, Marty has helped me with that so much in a couple pieces we've made on this podcast where we're totally stuck. And then he just grabs the parts he likes the best and says, okay, we're going to work with this and make a new section. And then, of course, the two sections go together because those parts are already well acquainted. The other thing that's cool about inventions, even though they're a very old school and sort of nerdy expression of music, they're kind of a lot like jazz, I realize. A lot of, and I'm not a jazz musician, but a lot of jazz songs have something called the head, which is the theme. And usually the jazz song comes on and the players are playing and someone plays the head or they play the head together. Maybe the saxophone player and all the horn players are playing the head in that theme. And then they go through sort of solos of different sort of types of solos. There's something called trading fours with a drummer and someone go back and forth. Maybe there's just a whole solo section where saxophone player is soloing. And usually what jazz players do is they take that head or that theme and they play around with it. Which is just like the development of an invention where they're sort of doing these variations, they're improvising and referencing it and having fun with it. And that's why sometimes I feel like if you don't know the format of jazz or you don't have a great ear or they're really doing crazy stuff, sometimes jazz is a little bit inaccessible. And honestly, I don't have a great ear, but a lot of times when I listen to jazz, I can hear references to the head, and then other times I'm like, I don't know what they're trying to go for here. So that's a really fun thing to do if you listen to jazz, is sort of listen for that head and listen for references to it throughout the piece. Okay, let's do some examples. So I remember this song just blowing my mind when I first heard it. And this is back in the day when I was deep in my classical phase studying classical music. And there came a point where all I was listening to is classical music, which sounds so crazy today. But here, let me pull this up. And I'll pull it up on the screen, but you don't need to see this. I'll just play some of the music for you. So this is a Sinfonia by Bach, Sinfonia number 9 in F minor, BWV 795, played by Glenn Gould, and it's an invention. And so let's play the beginning, and I'll just sort of pause it at different points to sort of talk about what we're hearing. So listen for this theme, the first theme in the right hand. So stop right there. It's an introduction of this sort of, I'll call it an eerie idea. And then it actually sounds like it goes up. And you start hearing this other melody in the same pitch zone as the initial melody. So let's listen to that again and try to hear the same thing twice. You're going to ignore one thing. So you're going to hear the melody once. A second melody is going to come in the same pitch zone, I'm calling it. And the melody will be played again higher up, the first melody. So let's see if we can hear that. So that's the initial melody. So now we're going to hear that same thing higher up with another melody underneath. So that's the end of that second section. Pretty interesting, right? And we'll listen a little bit further just to sort of see what happens. And maybe I'll skip around a little bit, but it's very fun to get into these. So this is a transformative part. We're moving to some new area. There's that melody again. So that means we're moving to another section. You can sort of hear it ending and being very final in that sort of formal way that they did a lot back in the day. So I'll leave it at that. I think that's a really cool piece. And if you one of my favorite things to do is just look up this piece, Symphonia number 9 in F minor, and you have to put BWV 795. Find the sheet music and just watch the sheet music as someone plays it. It sounds crazy, but you'll see more patterns. It's kind of a fun little challenge too, especially if you're not used to reading music. You just have to see the patterns in the notes and say, hey, this melody is the same as this melody here. And Imagine playing that too. You're playing it in one hand and you have to play it in the other hand with the other hand play something else. So it's a very fun, totally musically nerdy activity. But I highly recommend it. So one thing that's interesting about counterpoint is that there's lots of these rules. And like in an invention, you kind of have to have the exposition and the development, and usually you do this and that. Those are sort of rules or limitations. And oftentimes in music, rules and limitations, people reject them, but I think they're so important. If I say go write a poem about literally anything, it's like, where do you start, right? So oftentimes I like using rules and limitations as a starting point to help you just do something. And then you know what? If you have a reason that you want to break the rule, of course. They're just tools in the tune shed, you know? But these are just ways to think about music that are fun. So in counterpoint, they developed all these principles. And you can imagine Bach back in the day teaching these principles to his students, right? You have to do it this way, you have to do it that way. And we did this in school too. And actually it's really fun. It does take some creativity out of it. But you can mess around with this later, and I'll show you in a piece that I wrote about how I messed with the creativity of it in a minute here. But first, I want to talk about some of these rules that they use in counterpoint to combine melodies well. And what's interesting is if you just go and write a melody and then write another melody and try to make them make nice chords when they're all together, but they're both separate melodies, you'll find that there's certain things that if you do them, it just causes problems. You get stuck. You get to a point where you can't make a chord that's really the chord you want. So it can be very difficult. So they wrote these rules to actually help the melody sit together nicely, sort of as long as you follow them, you can do whatever you want in the melody and you're good. So it's a limitation, but in a way it also sort of gives you freedom once you've mastered these rules. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll just give some examples. I'm just reading these off Wikipedia. Permitted melodic intervals are the perfect unison, the fourth, the fifth, and the octave, as well as the major and minor second, major and minor third, blah, blah, blah. All ascending minor sixths must be immediately followed by motion downwards. Okay, that's kind of a lot of information. Let's think about some other ones. If you're writing two skips in the same direction, so skips being jumping more than one note in the scale. Something that must only rarely be done. The second must be smaller than the first, and the interval between the first and the third note may not be dissonant. And I don't know why Wikipedia has these two rules first. These are sort of the more detailed rules, but there's some very simple ones like don't do parallel fifths. So if you have one voice singing a fifth away from another voice, and then they both move up a step, that's a parallel fifth. Or if they both move down a step. And if you hear that on a piano, go play that on a piano or go look up examples of parallel fifths. It's not that it sounds bad, although back in the day they did think it sounded bad, which is funny. But it'll help you keep more interest in more independent melodic lines if you don't do that motion. Let's see, the interval of a tritone, which is just a certain interval, in three notes should be avoided. For example, ascending melodic motion F, A to B. As an interval of a seventh and three notes. So there's all these different things that they made up, and you could just Google these things and maybe just try some counterpoint, but just do a few of them. Try not to do unisons except for at the beginning or the end. That's when two notes are exactly the same or two voices are singing the same note. Here's the easy rules. Oh, I found the good ones. Avoid parallel fifths or octaves between any two parts. Avoid moving in parallel fourths. Do not use an interval more than three times in a row. Attempt to use three parallel thirds or sixths in a row. Attempt to keep any two adjacent parts within a tenth of each other. That's an important one. You don't want them singing too far apart if you're thinking about singers or your hands in the piano too far apart, unless an exceptionally pleasing line can be written by moving outside of that range. So sometimes I have to ignore the language on these things because people really get hung up. Oh, you're telling me I can't do this, I can do this. I think the beauty of it is that you can do whatever you want, but following the rules gives you something to try and break the rules when you want to. And that seems like a good enough transition. I'm trying to see if there's anything else I wanted to cover. I think that's it. Good enough transition to a song that I wrote. So I'm going to stop my share here and jump over to a song I wrote where I used counterpoint technically, but very, very, very simply. And I think this is a great way to do it. You don't need to know these rules, and you're probably not going to write music with all these rules all the time. It's a great exercise to go through it though, so I recommend it. Okay, so here's the story of this song. This one's called Alyssa's Song. My cousin's kid, and I always forget, is that my second cousin? I don't know. She lives near my aunt, and she plays flute, and my aunt plays cello. And so I wrote them a little piece to play together because my aunt's always trying to play more cello and she's learning flute. And I'll just play a little bit for you and then I'll sort of explain the problem I had. And this is just MIDI, so it's not going to sound as good. Also, the cello line, you have to imagine it being pizzicato, which means plucked. So like boom, blump, instead of like bowed. So you'll hear this little MIDI instrument. I'll just play it for you a little bit. Listen to the melody. And right now I'm kind of doing it singer-songwriter style, as they say. I sort of have the melody going with just the chords underneath and the cello. And then I'll stop it at the end of the first little bit of melody where I got stuck and talk about how I used counterpoint to help me get out of that situation. So here's the piece. So right there is sort of the end of introducing the melody. I think the idea is kind of exhausted. You know what the melody is. The cello's just been doing these kind of do-bop chords for a while, and it's time to switch things up. So I wanted to put the cello to start bowing now, and I didn't know exactly what to do with the flute. So I did a very simple counterpoint technique where you essentially take the main melody that the flute was doing and put it in the cello. And so I just did that. I just literally transposed it down into the range of the cello and boom, it's playing it. And then I said, okay, well, now what should I put in the melody of the flute? Well, I started writing some stuff. And whenever notes lined up, I made sure that they were in a chord that I liked, in a chord that was sort of part of the key, in a chord that wasn't. It was consonant when I wanted to be consonant, dissonant when I wanted it to be dissonant. So, for example, not just a bunch of notes all clustered together that are random, but notes that sort of fit together and sound good. And I literally just used my ear for this. And every once in a while, I couldn't, it wasn't working out. So, what I did is I broke the rule. I'd go to the cello and say, you know what? I need this note to be a little bit lower. And no, it's not going to be the exact same melody anymore, but it's going to be close. And it's going to be different. And I like that. It's a progression of the melody, right? It's not like the melody is just like copy and pasted down to the cello part. Well, at first it was, but I wanted it to change a little bit. We're progressing through a feeling and an emotion here. So I wanted it to be different. And then I just wrote a melody in the flute and made sure those notes lined up. And it's actually an analysis. Like you can go through here and be like, okay, I got an F in the cello and I have a D in the flute. Okay, so an F and a D. I'm looking at the piano. So that could be a whole bunch of chords, but it could be a D minor chord. So maybe I just write down D minor. And then I look at the rest of the measure and say, okay, most of these notes are actually kind of D minor chords. Sometimes there's something called a passing tone in between. So, like if you're walking up a scale, maybe one of those notes just kind of doesn't count towards any chord. It's just sort of a note in between. We call that a passing tone. And those are some of the elements of counterpoint that if you just Google and read about counterpoint, you will find these little terms. And they're helpful for analyzing your music and fixing these issues. And then you can make these two beautiful melodies that go together. So hopefully, I'll play this a couple times, but hopefully you can hear the original melody in the cello. You can also hear a new melody in the flute, and that melody should be good enough on its own. It should be a standalone melody. It's not just chords at this point. So I'll actually play a little build up, or actually, I'll just start it from right here. And yeah, give it a listen. the flute and the cello are playing the exact same thing. Uh-oh, that's a bunch of parallel motion. That's against the rules of counterpoint. But I said, I don't care. It sounds like they're doing their own thing, but I want them to also be together. I wanted that feeling of unison there. I also wanted a good landing spot for my second cousin, I guess, and my aunt to play together, right? They're playing different parts for a while. I want to make sure they're on the same page. I don't want this to be too crazy of a piece, so I did that. And I'm just gonna back it up a little bit so you can hear that one more time. So you notice we're in a different things happening now. The melody has been taken up by the flute again, and the cello is playing broken chords again. So we're sort of out of that counterpoint part, but I'm still making sure that these chords are all matchy matchy and good. Oops, I skipped way forward. And then right there is where it actually goes back to, I guess in an invention it would be called the recapitulation, where we play the melody one more time, to sort of send us off. But of course, I didn't want to just play the melody one more time. I wanted to change it up and have a feeling end the piece. So I'll play this out for you. That's how it ends. So it's not this whole, we're going to play the melody a couple times like we did in the beginning. It's just one more time so you recognize it and feel it. Okay, so I broke that up a lot. I'm actually just going to put it back to the beginning and play it through one more time so you can try to catch some of these things. Try to track where that melody is going. Is it being played in the flute? Is it being played in the cello? Or are we just doing something else? And all of those happen in this very short song. But yeah, we'll do that to play it out. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you have any questions, email us at thetuneshedpodcast@gmail.com. It's been fun nerding out with you today. Hopefully, you can take this to practice and catch you next time. Much love.